Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome again to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. It is Wednesday, April the 1st, 2020, and tempting though it might be to make lame jokes about April Fool's Day, there's not an awful lot to joke about at the moment, certainly not in the main stories of the news. And of course, as before, there is really only one story out there, and that is the current COVID-19 pandemic and the impact it's having on society in general, and of course, construction as well. So we will be talking about that. I'm David Taylor. I'm the editor of the Construction Index magazine. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleague, Phil Bishop, who does our online news. Good morning, Phil. Hello. How are you? You well?
All good. All good. Staying good. Very well indeed. Good. Thank you. And you?
I'm very well, yes, yes. I'm just carrying on as normal, as far as possible anyway.
Quite a month, hasn't it?
Yeah. Where to start? This pandemic, to begin with, seemed not to have too much impact on the construction industry, but it has affected virtually every aspect of it.
Including
now.
The English language. When we get to the end of the year, when there was talk about what was the word or phrase of the year that's entered the dictionary for the first time,
yeah.
We already know that the phrase of the year is social distancing.
Yeah.
It is something we'd never heard of just, 5 weeks ago. And now it's the most coined phrase that you'll hear in the news or in the supermarkets, yeah. When you're doing your Tesco trolley jams, if you manage to get down to a supermarket. It's the whole thing. And that's what's been throwing the construction industry into a risk assessment frenzy.
It certainly has.
And we're starting to see some sort of, not normality, it's still a state of flux, of course it is, but some sort of way forward. Modus operandi.
You're quite right about the state of flux, because I think that we reached a stage about this time last week, I think, where contractors genuinely didn't know what they were supposed to do. And some were saying, well, we ought to stop working immediately. We ought to close our sites and everybody go home and stay safe. Because it was this time last week, if you remember, that there were all the pictures on the national media of construction workers crammed into tube trains traveling to work, and everybody was immediately up in arms saying, we can't have this, we've got to close down every construction site. And there has been guidance produced, hasn't there, since then, industry guidance from the Construction Leadership Council about, you know, if you...
Well, we had that guidance last time we spoke, but what's happened now is some sort of understanding of implementing it. Initially they started off implementing it, and you said, well, hang on a minute. If there's a site on accident, you've got to get within 2 metres of them. And then you've got to drain the NHS to come and sort out this injured person. And more particularly than that, what hadn't at first been thought of was the getting people to and from work, particularly in London.
Yeah.
So they now started saying, let people turn up early or late, trying to stagger the journeys. But more broadly, it's the whole question of what is critical, urgent work. And some housing developers have decided, well, we're not that urgent. We're gonna hold off. We're gonna shut our sites for a few weeks, only a few weeks. We're just gonna pause, and no one's gonna be buying houses in the next 3 weeks anyway.
Yeah.
So the urgency sort of dropped off a bit. And then the house builders, which wanted to keep working, like Barclay Homes and Redrow, they found that although they wanted to keep working, the builders' merchants had all shut up shop, and they couldn't get the supplies in. So they thought, well, sod this. We're trying to work. We can't. We might as well, beat them, join them, and going home. We then had ministerial intervention. The governor said from the outset that construction can keep going. You keep your key workers. And other people have said, well, it's hardly, building luxury flats for Chinese, Malaysian investors who are never going to live in them in parts of London or whatever is hardly urgent or crucial. What's that going on for? So a lot of the big London sites have shut down because of difficulties getting people to site and maintaining the social distancing rules on site and off site. But at the same time, we've had both the junior business minister, Nadeem Zahawi, writing a letter in the Daily Telegraph saying, no, it's wrong to criticise people who are going to work. All this sort of shut the sites hashtag that's been trending. He basically, without saying so, dismissed them as a bunch of lefties and revolutionaries and who are anti-capitalists. And actually, we needed people to carry on working for the sake of the economy. And whether it's construction or packing boxes in an Amazon warehouse, there are jobs that still need to be done. And, you know, don't bash the bosses, which I think it is fair. A lot of the bosses are having these decisions taken out of their hands. On the one hand, it's the government is saying, we want you to keep working. And on the other hand, it's the clients who are saying, we want you to keep working. Now, a lot of the clients, like Crossrail and HS2 and so on, they said, no, go home. We can wait for however long it takes. But, yeah, a lot of construction is going on where the 2 meter rule can be observed.
And I've seen some interesting photographs recently of people having site briefings before starting work, and they're occupying an awful lot of space, and they're all standing 2 meters apart, and there's somebody there, not with a megaphone, though he probably needs one to reach the people at the back. But people are doing it. You know, they're going to work, and they're, as far as possible, observing these new distancing rules. So life goes on in some sites, at least.
Did you see that splendid photo that Network Rail put out of a father and son who are working together on a railway maintenance job up in the northwest somewhere? It's a lovely photo, but they both had not only the full PPE rigmarole, they're both wearing what looked like divers' helmets. I mean, not even motorbike helmets, but divers' helmets they looked to be wearing. And you thought, how can they possibly work in that? But they look fully protected and fully 2 meters apart and carrying on doing. And proper urgent work, or critical work, keeping the railways open, even if we're not travelling on them, are medicines, supplies, goods. People who do need to travel on them are travelling on them. We need to keep the railways open, and therefore there's lots and lots of work that does need doing.
And we do have a list, didn't we? Because now, you reported online, didn't you?
I was going to say, I've got that in front of me, and it's a great list, an interesting list, and we've even had some comment as to what needs adding to it. But should we first talk about some of the broadly critical letters that have come in, people emailing us, voicing not only their concerns, but the concerns that they've heard other people share. And the broad consensus of people who are writing in is that more sites should be closing closing, even though my own personal sense of the people I'm still seeing around when walking the dog or whatever and talk to is that those who are still working are really glad that they're still working. The idea of being stuck at home fills them with absolute dread and terror. So I think there is, I don't know if it's a silent majority, but there's certainly a silent mass of people who really, really want to keep working, not just for the money, but because they want to get out.
I think most of the letters or emails we've had mainly been from, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're mainly from sort of people further down the supply chain. They're not the tier one contractors. They're mainly specialist subcontractors, and usually the bosses or owners of subcontractors.
Well, let's face it, most
concerned
of the industry
employers,
in
other words. Yeah.
Yes, but most of the industry in that category. I mean, hardly anyone's in tier one.
No, that's true. Some very strong opinions voiced here as well. And there seems to be a conflict, a sort of a rift somewhere in the supply chain at some point where the employer is determined to carry on as normal, presumably because they've got a lot of money riding on it and they have been encouraged by the government to carry on working. But site workers further down the supply chain who are understandably concerned about their exposure to this virus, and of course that that concern is accentuated by the outcry last week about people travelling on the tube. They don't want to be exposed. They don't want to take the risk. They don't want to take the virus home. And so the employers seem to be saying, we don't want our staff to be exposed to this virus. We want to send them home. But they're being told in no uncertain terms that they've got to get to work, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, there's one particular person who wrote in saying that they, I'm not clear whether they are a boss or the boss, but they are involved in a specialist subcontractor, which has got projects in operation on sites all over the country, politely wrote to clients saying that while they would maintain emergency cover, essentially they were sending everyone home because they didn't feel they could comply with the site operating procedures, which they now need to. I quote, "In our letter, we politely laid out our reasoning, the need to follow government instruction, and that as a competent and socially aware subcontractor, this is the correct course of action. Also noting that we would like the letter to constitute an official request for an extension of time. We are obviously prepared to take the financial consequences of not working and bear our own costs, as far as they relate to our staff, ongoing operational costs and overheads, etc."
Sounds pretty reasonable
to me. Right, he says, "We have to say that we've been hugely disappointed by the response from many quarters. We've received a plethora of delay notices and other contractual and commercially aggressive correspondence, despite our site production activities not being behind in any way at this point." So he ends, "Unfortunately, after much assessing the commercial risk, we had no option but to write back to all our clients, letting them know that we're now back in full operation. We've done this under duress because the extent of the potential claims could sink the company."
That's pretty dreadful, isn't it?
Yeah, it's no doubt some people will say that, you know, this guy's one of those bad bosses forcing their people to work.
Yeah.
But he's forcing his people to work because someone's forcing him.
Yeah.
And that's the supply chain. You know, that's how someone's forcing someone all the way down the line, I guess.
Yeah. This is the same chap who I think he concluded by saying that the government should grant all contractors a 1 month extension of time. So there's no argument, you know, go home and, you know, don't try and argue about the fine detail. It should be a clear message. And it's interesting because I'm sure this is going to become a theme of these discussions, that the old practice of what's known as subby bashing seems to be still alive and well, that the contractor has its own priorities and it expects its supply chain to fall in line with that. And, you know, if that means ordering them under duress or under threat of legal action to turn up and work in what probably constitute unsafe circumstances, then that's what they'll do. They're quite happy to do that. So, you know, it is a shame. And he's not the only person who's said things like this. I mean, somebody else wrote to us and said that this is an M&E contractor who said he's astounded by the main contractor's stance. He said, "We have sites where we have shut down quite quickly, others where it is business as usual and the get to site or else mentality is prevalent." So, you know, it's out there. People are sort of wielding the big stick.
Yeah, and certainly what I see on social media is full of, as I say, this shut the sites and it's appalling. And people are quite adamant that it wound up that absolutely no construction work needs to go ahead at all. I mean, I've had, did you see the one from the chap invoking the war? He's saying that
oh, yes.
construction workers who are going to work at the moment on site are the same as those Germans who obeyed the Nazis in 1939 and 1945.
Yeah.
They were so wrong and history told us so. Doing what the government says is no excuse for committing crimes against humanity.
Yeah.
So we have at least one correspondent who thinks it's a crime against humanity to carry out construction work. I understand that strong feelings are being engendered, but I'm to start talking about corporate manslaughter at this stage. It may come to that, but at this stage, I can't.
It's a bit premature.
It's a bit ripe there. Let's get on to that list, and you've got it as well.
The list of critical works. Yeah.
No, this is not an official list at all. This is just an important chap, a guy called Graham Watts, who's the chief executive of the Construction Industry Council, which is the umbrella group for all the professions, the Institution of Civil Engineers and the architects and surveyors and so on, all sit round a table under the aegis of the Construction Industry Council. And I suspect he was motivated to do it purely because, or as a reaction to everyone saying, well, what is urgent? What is urgent?
Yeah.
Work? Should we be going to work? Shouldn't we be going to work? And he makes the point that even if you're not going to work, you can't just walk away from a site. You know, sites have to be, the closure of sites is a managed process. I think we talked about this last week.
Yeah.
Be wound
yes,
down.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, do you want to get through the list, David, and point out something that he quite rightly points out?
Right at the top of the list is one which I think nobody would argue with, which is making good unsafe buildings or dangerous structures. I mean, clearly, if you have an unsafe structure, you've got to do something about it before something disastrous happens. So sending people in to make a building safe is perfectly understandable. The same with structural inspections and, you know, sort of roofing problems, glazing replacement, locksmithing, gas safety work, which is an obvious one, and electrical safety work as well.
I think all utility work comes in there, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Somewhere other than the list. Utility maintenance, utility connections, all those sort of things.
Yeah. But then there's also work which in itself, as construction work, isn't necessarily urgent, but actually facilitates operations which are important and urgent. So, for example, essential maintenance of morgues and funeral parlours and crematoria, and we couldn't have our mortuaries overflowing or our hospital air conditioning units breaking down, you know, at a time like this. That sort of work is clearly going to be important.
But if hospitals and health services are important, so is food and all the food supplies. So you've got all the farms and factories, the food processing factories, they all need maintenance work and upkeep, or new factories are being built. The new hand sanitizer factory is under construction now. So that's a big job, which is going ahead of double quick time. We need extra warehouse space. Everything to support the food industry, but then everything to support anything that we need. We still need washing powder. We still need...
Well, there's a nice sort of catch-all right at the end of the list. Work on factories that make materials that are vital to all elements on this list. So, I mean, basically that blows the field wide open. Yeah, I think really common sense is required here. I think most people, if they think about it, can decide whether or not the work that they're engaged in or the work that they're asking other people to do for them is important. As you said right at the beginning of this conversation, clearly if you're fitting out luxury apartments for overseas investors, it's probably not all that important, certainly not to in the wider scope of things. But other things like making sure that roads are passable and that railways are still operating and that hospitals can operate and all the rest of it. Clearly, I don't think anybody would seriously argue that that's the sort of work that can be put on hold for the time being.
And Graham Watts also remembered a large group of people who the media seem to have forgotten, the national media seem to have forgotten and not reported on, which is all those people who are still homeless from the floods of last month or whatever it was, 2 months ago now. There's still flood repair work and flood remediation work going on. And can you imagine the combination of having your house you can't move back into your house yet. And you've got the lockdown going on. I mean, how difficult and frustrating is it for those poor people?
Well, it must be appalling because, I mean, obviously you're basically camping out. I mean, it's all right for you and I in the comfort of our own homes where we have everything we need around us. And, you know, presumably by now we have stocked up on the toilet rolls that were unavailable last week. Whereas people who are basically, left their homes with what they could carry and left everything else there, they can't go out and buy new clothes or do anything like that. They're stuck in, I don't know, a motel or a hotel or something like that. Temporary accommodation with the bare minimum of clothing and equipment. So, yeah, that's bad. And, yes, how many people remember those floods? This seems
last year's news now, isn't it? But it's not.
Yeah,
it is. Can I just chuck into the mix of the list of urgent works a suggestion which Graham Watts didn't include, but one of our correspondents did? And he says, many domestic properties have refurbishment works partially completed on them at the moment, often involving scaffolding. Now, he says it's essential that works are completed to a stage that enables the scaffolding to be removed. Scaffolding left in place is an attraction to children who see this as a climbing frame to play on. While the lockdown's in place, there'll be children. He says the children should not be playing outside, but if you've got a garden, you will let your children play outside naturally. And he says,
yes, of course.
He says the temptation to climb the scaffold will just be too much, and the risk of falling is too great. So scaffolds on domestic houses, at least those who have got children living inside them or next door to them, need to come down. And I thought that was a really good point.
Yeah, I agree.
Or at least make it impossible to, you know, bore them up to make it impossible to climb them. That's something that we could add to the list.
Well, my children are all grown up now, so they can look after themselves. But my heart goes out to those parents who are in lockdown and they've got two or three energetic, boisterous and bored kids at home. And if they've got a garden, then maybe they're lucky. But if they haven't, how do you bottle that up? And how do you prevent those kids from driving you mad? And how do you keep them indoors?
I believe there's medication available.
I know. Yeah. Yes, well, let's not go there. Getting out and about, we've made this remark many times, made this point many times, that you and I work from home. We're not actually required in the line of duty to venture very far from our own homes. We tend to do everything from our desks rather than go out and have to meet people and mix with society, which, of course, suits misanthropic people like us. But there was a time when, I mean, other journalists, they have to be out. You can't stay at home and do an investigative piece from your desk. You've got to get out there. You've got to get the story. Time was when you and I both would have been regularly going out, finding stories, reporting from the field, as it were, and going out on press trips. Do you ever miss those days, Phil? I mean, you're confined to quarters just like I am on a regular basis. This is our new normal. Do you ever miss those press junkets we used to go on?
I think it's a younger man's game. I once worked for a number of years on a publication which required a lot of international travel, and I enjoyed it for a few years, but there's only so many airports and factories and hotels you can take. But my, yeah, they've been some good ones. You had a favourite trip?
Yeah,
or least
in fact, I worked. I've got both of them at both ends of the spectrum. I mean, a lot of the time, a press trip, you get on a coach and you go and see a factory or something like that. And I always felt, because I just like you, worked on an international magazine at one point, which took me all over the world. But I always felt frustrated because I only ever saw airports and factories. And I was going to exotic places like India and Japan and Hong Kong and Scandinavia, and seldom actually got to see anything of those places. Now, I think my most favourite press trip sort of fell into my lap. It wasn't a normal sort of one. It was there was a Finnish cladding company which was doing a promotion in the architectural press in the UK. The prize, there were five prizes, and it was a week in Lapland. I got called up by the PR man who was running this promotion because one of the prize winners had dropped out and they had a spare ticket. And he said, would you like to come along and maybe you'll get a story out of it? And I thought, oh, great, some Scandinavian steel cladding, can't wait. But anyway, I said yes. And so off I went and met my fellow travellers, all architects who were readers of this particular architectural magazine. But anyway, we went off to Scandinavia. We spent a morning drinking coffee in a meeting room in a cladding factory. And then after that, it was just a catalogue of skiing, snowmobile safaris, reindeer trekking. We went out into the Baltic on an icebreaker and put survival suits on and jumped in the sea and bobbed around like that. Went to visit a very interesting town called Kemi, which is up on the Baltic coast, right at the top. It's just a big paper mill with a few houses in it. And its one main attraction is the Towel Museum. So we had a look around that, lots of towels, flannels, bathrobes and that kind of thing.
Paper towels?
Oh, no, these were all fluffy cotton ones of various different patterns. It was a bizarre trip, but very enjoyable. At the back of my mind, I felt guilty, though, because I thought, I'm taking a week out of the office and I'm not going to come back with anything to write about. But in the end, I just wrote about what I did on my holidays and it actually got... it got a good response in the press. So that was probably my favourite trip. What was yours?
I suppose if I had the two types of trips that one does, or I have done, I suppose, as a journalist, one where, like the one you're talking about, where someone is paying for it and be our guest and let us show you how fabulous we are. And the other is where the editor, or on your own initiative, but normally the editor will say, we need to find out what's going on. Get on an airplane and go find out. And I used to work for a magazine with a large, a weekly news magazine with a large staff that was very keen to be the first to find out why a bridge had fallen down or a hole had appeared in the ground or something. And they were quite fun, but always hard work. And you never quite felt you'd come back with... You can never really enjoy it because you never felt you'd come back with the full story. The ones where you can just sit back and be spoon-fed and enjoy are the jollies, which we really shouldn't be going on as honest journalists. But the biggest and the best are those come from companies who are in some kind of deep doo-doo and need to win friends quickly. And the cheapest way to win friends is to buy them. So I've had trips from American waste management companies, which took in baseball games and Chicago Cubs and things like that. But the one that really took the biscuit was a Brazilian construction company called Odebrecht. And we're going back, I would say, 25 or 30 years here, 25 at least years here. And Odebrecht still gets the same sort of headlines. If you think it's a South American version of a Skanska or a BAM or something, it's everywhere. Yeah. It's one of the biggest private companies in Brazil, privately owned. I think it's still privately owned. What's the Odebrecht family involved? And they were badly implicated in a huge political scandal when Ferdinand Collor was the president of Brazil. And it's about the same time they just moved into Europe. They bought George Wimpey's offshore business, offshore engineering business, and they're involved in a joint venture building the Tagus Crossing in Lisbon.
So that dates it
for those who remember that project. And their name was mud at home, and they were worried about their name becoming mud everywhere else in the world, which they were trying to conquer. And so they went on a big charm offensive with the, not just, I don't think it was just the trade press, but certainly I managed to be lucky enough from my particular publication I was working for at the time to get that trip. Arrived on a Friday night, I was met, looked after, had the weekend to kill, so went to see Sao Paulo play, I can't remember who it was, football. So going to a football match in Brazil is on most people's bucket list, or should be. So that was all fabulous. I went to the beach on Sunday and Sugarloaf Mountain and all that sort of stuff. And then Monday work started. And I can't remember how long the trip was, but there's quite a lot of travelling around in coaches, so it wasn't all fun. But the bizarre bit was part of the trip, but then it went to Peru to see some projects. Odebrecht were building canals in the desert there. Now, the only person in South America at that time who was even in bigger trouble than Odebrecht politically was the president of Peru, a chap by the name of Alberto Fujimori, who before the year was out, or the following year was out at least, was in jail for all sorts of corruption charges. He essentially hijacked, there's some foreign journalists, I need to make some foreign friends. And he said, I'll have them, bring them to me instead. And so we were wheeled into the presidential palace. And I was the only non-Spanish speaker in the group. I was the only European in the group. I had no idea what was going on. I was just following along and occasionally managed to pick things up. And then discovered the chap who, at the end of the table, and I say the end of the table, there's only seven or eight of us around the table, was the president of Peru. And we ended up spending the entire day with him, going off in motorcades, opening schools on the campaign trail, each taking in turns. I had to make a speech to declare this school open at some stage, and it was the most bizarre trip. It turns out the good story for me, as working for Civil Engineering magazine, is that Fujimori himself was an agricultural engineer, but very interested in his wife, a civil engineer. And when I started asking about civil engineering, he said, they got very animated and said, but let's take a detour. He took me to, he had a private depot where he buys up any old bit of construction machinery that is going spare, going to waste. He would buy it up, get it done up and put it to work on the roads or wherever. He's quite, for all his faults, he was quite the ultimate populist. He did things in the shortcuts, yes, or whatever. His hobby at weekends was doing motorbikes. He'd get old motorbikes or motor scooters, do them up and give them to the local flying doctors who could get out into the ghettos. And lots of these sort of good deeds off his own bat that he did. But he rather thought that the rules were for other people, which were landing him up in trouble. But that was the story of my day with the president of Peru, which was... It was bizarre.
Sounds like fun. Are you still in touch with him?
No. Although he has a daughter who I last saw blowing bubblegum bubbles with a Sony Walkman on her head, wearing rollerblades, rollerblading around the corridors of the presidential palace in Lima. And she's now a president. She's now a presidential candidate there.
Oh, so really?
I knew her when she was a roller skater. Well, we're just about running out of time here, I think, David, looking by my watch. But I'm hoping that April will be slightly less interesting than March, that we can be slightly calmer times and we can start to see the end of the situation we're in. But March was a remarkable month. I mean, certainly the appetite for news and information from our own website, constructionindex.co.uk, a record month. We... normally lucky to get 500,000 users a month on a good month. March 2020, our record ever month, 690,000. So a 30% upswing in traffic in March. That's how busy it's been. Equally in growth mode is this podcast. And I think we want to say, David and I would like to say thank you to all of those who have been listening to us. And if you're coming to us late, we hope you stay with us. I can tell you that we've had 160,000 download since we started doing this in late January, which works out at 16,000 average per issue, which is remarkable. I thought we'd be lucky if we get 500 of you. I didn't know I knew that many people. And just in the past week alone, David, you may not know this, 30,000 downloads.
Wow, no, I didn't
just
know
in
that.
The past week.
That is good.
We seem to be gathering some momentum for whatever reason. So thank you, all of you. We are open to sponsorship opportunities if anyone with deep pockets or something to sell out there wants to use our channels to promote themselves, get in touch, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk, and we'll forward your inquiries on to the appropriate people. If you want to join the conversation, get in touch, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. But finally, David, did you see the Alok Sharma letter that's... in the news today?
He's
the Secretary of State for Business, who has been, I don't know, is persuaded to do this by the construction industry bosses who have his ear, or whether it's completely off his own bat. And if it's completely off his own bat, good man, I say. All this clapping for the NHS last week was fabulous and brought a tear to many eyes, including mine. But there are many other people beyond the NHS who also deserve a clap. I mean, Alok Sharma said, "My heartfelt and personal thanks for everything that each and every one of you in the construction industry is doing to support our joint national effort." And I would just like to echo that and add my thanks to all of you still doing a hard day's work in or out of the site, I should say, whether you're at home or on site. Keep going, folks.
Yes, I think life has to go on, Phil. I think everybody would agree with that. And these are trying times, and it's very... often very difficult to know how we ought to proceed, but it's good to know that the industry is continuing to make that contribution. I think that Mr. Sharma was quite right to sing their praises.
Well, folks, from me and David, it's goodbye for another edition of Reconstruction. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again same time next week.
Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagent UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.